Anecdotally, over the years, I've heard a lot of NGO people describe the culture of their organization as fairly conflict-averse. And many of us consultants and coaches share that same observation. Of course, this is a generalization, which means there are plenty of examples that don't align with this picture, especially in the campaigning sector. Still, other analysts have determined, based on research, that at all levels, individual, team or unit level, and organizational levels, our conflict management capabilities are just underdeveloped. Interestingly enough, at the same time, in the last 3 to 5 years particularly, we've seen a number of examples of especially mid to large size nonprofits and NGOs who've become quite preoccupied with internal strife. This may be about unequal resource distribution, the enduring fact that money still translates into power in many cases, and tensions around big organizational changes, how they have been managed, allegations of a toxic culture, racism, sexism, etc., can also be at the heart of this. And sometimes this conflict spills over into the media in not too flattering ways. I decided to interview my longtime occasional collaborator, friend, and one of the premier governance advisors in the NGO sector, Daniel Genberg. Daniel, as it happens, just got trained in conflict mediation, in addition to what he knows about governance. And he thinks the two are related to some extent. In this interview, you will hear the what, the how, and the why of this. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over 3 decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, listeners. This is Tosca at NGO Soul and Strategy. So let me tell you something about Daniel Genberg. He is based in Brussels, Belgium, and he's one of the foremost consultants in my mind on NGO governance matters, nonprofit and NGO governance matters. Daniel and I have known each other for a long time now and have worked together on several client governance-related engagements. He's a wonderful collaborator and a pleasure to work with, and I highly recommend you work with him. Recently, and this is what made me decide that I needed to have Daniel on the show, is he got trained in conflict mediation. And although he's only had a short time to use some of his newfound skills, and he'll tell us about that, I was keen to interview him. I've seen with my own eyes in the last 10 years or so that and you've seen it written up in the media that nonprofits and NGOs have been caught up in a fair amount of internal strife. The reasons for these are a mix of factors ranging from internal, what I call politicking, that hasn't actually much to do with the mission of the organization, to profound political and philosophical differences inside the organization, intergenerational differences, conflicts emanating from accusations of racism, sexism, toxic work cultures, etc. These conflicts take up a lot of energy, time, and therefore also resources and attention span. And I am increasingly worried that this level of internal strife is causing us to cannibalize ourselves By this, I mean that some organizations may be at risk of eating themselves alive and not being able to focus sufficiently on the external context and actually on contributing to external outcomes. So this is what drove me to ask Daniel to come on the show. So welcome, Daniel.
Thank you very much, Tosca. It's good to be here. Good to talk to you again.
Yes.
Thank you very much for that welcome.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I'm looking forward to it. It's complex. It's very complex, the what we're talking about, I suspect. So just a quick background on Daniel then. Independent advisor, as I said, on governance issues. And I saw, Daniel, on your LinkedIn feed, 14 years. You're going strong as an independent advisor. You offer consultancy services on not-for-profit governance, mediation, accreditation systems, and organizational development. You are, in that capacity, also a special advisor to Nestor Advisors, and that is a London-based advisory firm specializing in corporate governance and organizational design. Importantly, you were the director of governance at Amnesty, head of governance development at ActionAid, so lots of practitioner experience, as well as the head of governance and accreditation at the International Planned Parenthood Federation. And you're an anthropologist by background, and we may come back to that. So you're known for your expertise on NGO governance, but I'd like to focus this interview mostly, if we can, on conflict management capabilities in the nonprofit and NGO sector, conflict management skills, and systems. So I'm curious, Daniel, why did you decide to invest in this training on conflict mediation?
Good question. One that I've reflected on since I did the training earlier. Well, I guess it was last year now. We're early 2024. I had been looking at the training for a while. And the reason for that was that I came across many situations in organizations where I was called in to deal with what seemed to be a governance issue or a governance problem. And it turned out that, yes, there are structural issues in that situation. There are also process issues, but fundamentally and most importantly, there are people issues, meaning relationships that may have gone wrong, relationships that need mending, relationships that need to be clarified exactly to what they are. And so this is when I guess my anthropologist hat came on, when I realized that, yes, governance arrangements are made up of very important structures and processes that make this work, but the people that occupy these and make use of these processes and these structures are the key elements of any governance function. And there are a number of different parts to that people part that are very important for this. So when I realized that coming into these situations, it is, yes, about advising on the technical aspects of governance, but it is also very much on understanding exactly what the context is in the organization, how different people relate to each other, what motivates them, what drives them, and what would actually lead them towards engaging in a very constructive way to improve or to kind of remend the governance issue that may not be working at the moment.
Right.
So that basically I was drawn to this idea of mediation as a part of my toolbox, not to necessarily become a full-time mediator, maybe one day. But in fact, since then, I've made use of some of these tools and processes inside the kind of the work with governance, when the organization has been open to that and kind of realizing we're moving into that space now.
Right.
So that's what drove me, because it was basically discovering that there are tensions and conflicts that could be need to be resolved for the governance arrangement to work.
For the governance arrangement to work. Yeah, and that makes sense. So you've observed the particularly the INGO sector, the international NGO sector, for a long time. You're by training an anthropologist. And you've told me that you'd love to use your anthropology skills. So I'm curious, you've observed a lot of NGO behaviors over the years, both personal and interpersonal and organizational level behaviors, including conflict behaviors. And you've worked at these well-known NGOs that I mentioned before. Can you generalize a little bit from your practitioner and your advisory experience to tell us what kind of conflict-related behaviors that you have patterns and trends of conflict behaviors that you've seen?
I'd say they're of course different, but they're also interlinked often. And if I would categorize them at a high level, I would say there are those that are centered around resources. Mm-hmm. There are those that are then centered more around direction, strategic direction. So what should an organization do or say or speak out on in a specific situation, and how should they do that? So really speaking about who is the organization and where do they want to have impact? And the other one, the third one, is really around the understanding of different people's different roles in the organization. So what is the role of the board, and what is the role of management and the executive side of it? And this is not a matter of just clarifying job descriptions. It's really about how does this play out in each specific issue for that. When you were looking at resources, and I think one can make another abstraction here, because it's not only about who gets money from where, but it's also around power. And if you look in specifically around power inside organizations, if you look at it from a governance perspective, you could probably discern three different sources of this. You have the kind of the authority, which comes vested with a specific position, so a director or a board of directors. Mm-hmm. You have the power, which may or may not come with resources and money, but it may also come with lots of experience, lots of knowledge, lots of networks, lots of contacts that can be leveraged in an organization to kind of get what you want. And then, of course, sitting on the resources in terms of money and other kind of resources, meaning that you can kind of decide or not to withhold funding for something or not. And when these three do not get along, when you have the authority, which is not aligned to the other sources of power, which is then perhaps, again, not aligned to or maybe even reinforced by the access to resources, this can really destabilize this. So that can be a conflict of that relates back to how, for example, a board feels disempowered because they have a specific role and function, yeah, or should have, but they're kind of undermined by the other forces. And now, and then this can become, unfortunately, a very, very politicized debate about where should the organization go today. So I think we've seen in many organizations, things under COVID, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and yet more recent conflicts around the world have shown how different organizations are really torn to kind of position themselves and to align around something that doesn't become just a watered down positioning, but really one where the organizations position itself for impact. Yeah. So it's really quite, that those can all be sources of conflict. Then you have interpersonal conflicts, yes, either between personalities, but also inter-organizational ones, where perhaps different organizations inside the membership organizations can have difficulties to understand how does this relationship look from the other person's perspective, and so on. And that can kind of generate, or actually start to generate, conflicts or tensions in some ways.
Yeah, there's a whole lot in there that we'll have to unpack. Just a quick comment on what you just said about some of the external factors, like external conflicts in the world, geopolitical conflicts, military conflicts, etc., such as Ukraine, and now, of course, also Palestine, Israel. I just actually indeed learned that one of the NGOs that I'm familiar with is right now that is wrapped up in that conflict. Tell us a little bit more about that perspective taking. So when you said in these large federated or confederated organizations, you said people have a hard time understanding where people in another part of the organization are coming from. This is my lay language, right? You said about it. Tell us a little bit more about that.
It is, I think it comes with lots of different lenses. One is your functional lens, where... I think there are frustrations within organizations in terms of being respected for one's role. So I think some organizations have certain positions that are valued more than others because they are closer linked to the mission itself. So maybe some of the kind of back office or support functions are kind of valued in the culture of the organization a bit less.
Exactly.
So How does it look to really kind of chase people to make sure that you get the financial reporting on time when people are working? So kind of what they think is more important than that at that
yeah.
point. And so not realizing that there's one is part of a system that needs to work. There can also be certain geographies where it's a kind of a difficult for others to see what it is to work in a specific context or with specific responsibilities. So on the one hand, in an international NGO, you might have one part of the entity kind of generating resources. And the generation of those resources is made with the promise that there is impact somewhere else. And so you have the generation of resources in one part and the impact happening in a different part. And those are, of course, extremely important. They are intrinsically linked.
Yeah.
But the needs of those, perhaps the more flexibility on the implementation side and the more perhaps kind of reporting, making sure you get the right indicators and everything else and the receipts and everything else back on time. To understand each other's needs is really important. And that in times of abundance and in times of when people are really motivated by their work and they're having impact and there's a positive effect on that, that usually works. Of course, when resources are more scarce or
yeah.
when people are not quite guided by the strategy, that's when it can start to break down and you can start to see some issues there. So doing things upstream is quite important. And maybe if I can just get back to the CEO of mediation just to see how I see it fits in there.
Please.
And that is in a kind of a conflict situation inside an organization, it's not about getting out of the conflict. It's not really only about getting past an obstacle. So it's not only about, two parties that are in a dispute and they need to move on and they want to get as much as out of the dispute as possible. It's equally much, or perhaps even more, is about reestablishing relationships and just to reestablish trust. And so the mediation process needs to provide the space where one can start to understand what does this look like from the other side. And so the listening is really important, and the mediator as one that is can communicate to both parties, or if there are more than two parties, how this situation looks like from the other side, without kind of revealing everything that party has said, but helping the different parties to understand this from a different perspective, and perhaps see that the necessity to collaborate is not only one for one's own interest, but there is a collective interest of getting along and doing this better later on. So there is an element of learning, and there's an element of change coming out of these. And so it's not, it can't be just settled. It's not the conflict to be settled. It's one where you need to start to reestablish and self-identify the ways of working that need to be put in place to kind of continue.
What's the future to be more resilient against future conflict?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was actually going to ask you from the recent conflict mediation training you took, Daniel, what were the most useful tools or concepts that you had not encountered in practice or from other sources before? I'm curious.
I think that the one of the few, I mean, five or six, I think, big takeaways, if we have time for that. Mm-hmm. One is to kind of abandon the idea that this is about winning or losing in a situation.
Yeah.
Because if you start to reason like that, you're sure to lose both, everyone involved. And it's even not about finding a compromise. Finding a compromise can actually leave everyone feeling quite unhappy. And
yeah.
then if you put the perspective of we need to work together again on Monday morning, then feeling unhappy is not the best base for that.
Yeah.
And so that's not, so the compromise idea is not there. I think also there might be a frustration inside organizations, because usually I think when a mediator is called in or when an external facilitator is called in, the organization has been at it for a while. And so it's they've tried to resolve it. And they at one point they said, okay, we've tried everything, let's try something new. And so there's already an approach and a mentality there, which is, well, what can possibly change? We've tried everything. And so it's a matter of really understanding early on that any situation can be resolved if the participants really want to. And I think the fact that they make call on an external facilitator means that they have already realized that they need help. And so there's already a good, that's already a good sign that they really want to resolve this.
There's an openness. Yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, and that's one thing. Now, another part which I found very interesting, of course, is in the training was that if we stop this idea of winning and losing and compromise, and we see how can we make, I guess you say that in English, how can we make the pie bigger?
Yes.
Instead of looking how much do we get of the pie, but making it bigger. And what other things, except for that pie, are at play here that can be introduced? The very human element that the training also emphasized the importance of, meaning the importance of feelings.
Yeah.
Another thing it underlined very much was this process needs to help people to save face, because they may have someone else to kind of report back to.
Mm.
And to not lose face in front of that, either authority or colleague, is a very, very important element. So help people to find solutions that they will be proud of presenting and that they will feel ownership of is really key, because then they will be able to convince others. And to do that, and this was the thing that really kind of hit home with me as something new that I'm trying out, is to, in the space of the mediation time or process itself, one needs to establish a relationship in the conversations that makes sure that what people are able to try out something, out a thought without having to commit to it. So until something is kind of finally agreed, written down, anything that has been said or offered or tabled before that is not valid. So it's a space and in time where you can try out things without necessarily committing to them. And it's in those, I think, kind of opening up the box of possibilities that one can start to find the kind of things that actually link up people's interests and actually make them kind of go in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's the kind of the process part, which I, for one, was missing in my toolbox to see, okay, how can we get to that kind of opening up of possibilities and realizing that I need to let the other person think and maybe even think things that I don't agree with until we find a space where that is actually working. So that's how I found that this space could be helpful for organizations that have been at an issue for a longer time.
Yeah, super important and interesting. The last two points I found particularly intriguing, and they were new to me. I was fortunate enough to be mentored by somebody who has a strong background in conflict management. And so I knew about the first three concepts, but the last two are really interesting, and I'm so glad I asked that question. Daniel, let me probe a little bit more on what should people practically imagine from a step-by-step perspective when a conflict mediator is called into an NGO or a foundation or a nonprofit?
Well, it's one of the first steps in the process is to clarify to everyone involved what they should expect, some of the principles, some of the this idea of, you know, nothing is committed until it's written down.
Right.
And kind of agreed on. That's kind of one of the rules. Confidentiality of information is clearly one as well. So the mediator can go between the two parties and explore different things, but they will never reveal any information from the other party before, unless given permission to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Another important aspect is that the mediator is not the creator of the solution. The mediator is the facilitator of the process where the parties can start to build their own solution. And so there's really a question of restraint that is imposed on the facilitator, that you are not there to find a solution for them because they might not feel very happy with it. And again, we're coming back to this idea of if you're going to continue to work together and collaborate for the greater of the mission of the organization, you need to not only be motivated, you need to have a sense of ownership and to motivate the people around you on why is this actually a good solution. And if it is, well, the facilitator told us this is what to do, it's not going to be really owned. And so that's that part of that's really really important. And what they can expect, I think, is a very structured process, at least in this approach to mediation, a very structured process where the parties will hopefully come out with a solution that they not only agree to, but they see the sense of without feeling a loss or that they have failed. They will not be in this, for example, if you're looking at a conflict between a board and the management there, they're not going to find a completely new board and completely new management when they start work on Monday. So it's not that kind of change, but hopefully they're going to have opened up channels for communication and opened up ways of identifying things that are arising. It doesn't mean that they may not still not get along very well, but it kind of speaks to some of the needs. And these are one of the questions I think that kind of can come towards the end of a mediation process is kind of to implement this. What do you need in order to be able to do this? But also, what do you need to do differently for the other party to be able to do their part of the job? Mm. And I think here we're coming to some issues around NGO or nonprofit governance, which are kind of fundamental. And that is, for example, there is always an asymmetry of information between the two. Executive and the management always know more. On the other hand, they're going to spend a lot more time on the issues. It's their job, while the other ones are often unremunerated in a volunteer position, driven by passion and perhaps some other drivers as well. But and they may not have the skills as well in this. And in the nonprofit sector, sometimes the metrics that they use to kind of really measure performance and impact are not as precise as in some other sectors.
You mean the metrics for executive management or the metrics for the whole organization, including the board? What are you talking about?
So how do we know that the organization is kind of on the right track? What are the metrics that we're using to measure that? And that's sometimes not as clear. And right. I can just on a slight tangent here, because I think it's a role that is sometimes overlooked, and that's the role of the chair. And sometimes the role of the vice chair, which I find in some organizations are hugely underinvested in, I would say, because the chair is often in charge of many relations. And I'm coming back to the issue of relations and people again. They're often in charge of under the responsibility for having good relations between the members of the board.
Yeah.
But also often kind of playing a key role in the relation with management.
Yeah.
But also then sometimes playing a key role in the relationship between the board and perhaps another constituency, if there are members or if there are others that are kind of interested in what the board is doing. And so having that person trained in something and giving them the kind of background and capacity that they
need is
really, really important. Because the chair will, in 99% of the cases, be too, I wouldn't say shy perhaps, but would not necessarily come in and say, I would need this. They would come in kind of and be expected to lead the organization because it's a leadership position. To lead the organization by virtue of being a passionate and very knowledgeable and kind and good person. And there's probably some other skills needed in that position. And I think investing in training for chairs is a really important thing that an organization can do early on, because such training would involve being aware of conflict management issues, being aware of the signals of it, but also what tool are there to use and when. So I think that's a kind of a key.
That's really prevention. Interesting. I've never heard somebody say that last point. It's very, very helpful. So quite regularly, I hear both practitioners analyze themselves, their organizations, and also us consultants, analysts, etc., say that our sector is that there's a lot of conflict aversion and conflict avoidance that then eventually still leads to conflict, or at least it can. What's at the core of this perception, and is it valid or not as a generalized cultural behavior? That means it's not equally present in all organizations, obviously, that you and I know about, but still that there's a bit of a tendency in that regard.
I would tend to say yes, but I must say that maybe I'm lacking the kind of comparator that would maybe this is more widespread than in others. I think in politics we see this played out on the tabloids and other places openly with conflicts kind of being exposed and being part of the strategy as well.
Yeah.
I think there is probably a kind of being afraid of using the moment of conflict in a constructive way and trying to shy away from it. On the other hand, I think also people are not driven by conflict, but there's an energy in it where I think people maybe misdirected. So instead of, and this is maybe in the three categories I tried to outline in the beginning around resources, strategic direction, and relationships, or understanding of other people's roles, in the middle one. I mean, a really insightful and critical debate about where the organization should do is needed. I mean, that's not a conflict. That's a battle of the minds and the hearts about where should we be going.
It's important and in principle, very good and definitely not to be avoided, you're saying.
Exactly. If one can get some scenario thinking and some data into that debate, I think that helps a lot because it can really help to kind of test some of the ideas and the outcomes. I think maybe some other things that you mentioned around diversity and inclusion and equity, one is really needs to be careful around making sure that are the people that need to be in this space and heard in this space, are they actually there and are they able to participate? Or is this kind of dominated by a language, a specific kind of background or academic profile, et cetera? And I think this is where the idea of diversity on the board, for example, if we come back to governance, is really key. It's not to have just knowledge there. It's about having the right skills and competencies encounter the same issue from different perspective, and through that come to a better decision. Knowing well that while I agree with you for 5 minutes, Tosca, what when we walk away from here, we know we have a stronger decision because we have disagreed and come to a conclusion.
Yeah, or we've looked at an issue from different lenses and not just from one lens, for instance. Yes. And what are the implications where you do see conflict avoidance or aversion, at least at first or prolonged? What are the implications? What can that result in?
I think we encountered this in one of the assignments we did together, is that you have an entrenched view on who other people are and what they are. Meaning that whatever they try to do differently, they will still be interpreted as manifesting those characteristics that you have in your mental model of the other.
Yeah.
And once you are in those entrenched positions, it's really difficult to have a different kind of conversation. And you can see this very much when it comes to the issue of trust. I mean, I try to not to be too Cartesian, but sometimes I kind of put three elements of trust. One is around trusting someone because of their capacity or capability to do something.
So I'll
trust my father with my life, but not with my teeth because he's not a dentist. So that's that kind of capacity. The second one is really performance related. So how many times has this person made you happy because the person has delivered on what she said she would deliver?
Reliability,
exactly. Or, constantly failing to do that. That kind of erode trust. The most difficult one and that I have seen in organizations is the trust that is not there because you don't trust the intentions of the other person. So you think they're saying something in order to obtain something else. And when you have reached that point of there's really a need to kind of reset, reset some relations.
Yeah, seems particularly corrosive.
Yes. And I think that, and coming back to your question, I think that's where leaving things for too long and you get to this mental models of the other and impossibility to break out of these, that makes the conversation between those very difficult to actually have an honest one, because you can't trust what they're saying.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. And I mean, also kind of, this is not necessarily really backed up by data, but a number of us practitioners as well as consultants say that in campaigning organizations, there is a communication style that is what I would call, could be characterized more as persuasion. So I'm constantly communicating with others in order to persuade them of my opinion, of my stance, right, et cetera, that is not about listening, but it's about persuasion, right? And actually, you know, as I recall reading articles by people who research persuasion, they say persuasion is 80% about listening, but that's not how I see it enacted, if you will, in our sector always. So is there some truth to the fact that campaigning organizations have a particularly hard time in working through conflicts in a constructive and fairly expedient way, or not necessarily in your experience?
I mean, I wouldn't dare to say that they are, because like you said, it's not backed up by data.
Right.
It's a sense that I get as well.
Anecdotal.
Yeah, it's anecdotal. I think, and I don't see how it works in other organizations, and I'm sure it does also in organizations. I'm sure also in university and education facility institutions and other things where perhaps they're not campaigning, but they have ways of persuasion, perhaps that are different. And I think I'd like to come here at this point to the importance of the leadership. Because you cannot change a campaigner, from one day to the next. They're going to be, they can be very effective also, but.
Yes.
But if the leadership of an organization constantly, kind of celebrates that behavior, in a way, also internally, then that is going to be something that people either kind of, you abandon because, I'm not good at that, or you find another way. And so if the leadership is aware of this, they can change that. I think the tone at the top here is really key. One thing, and I'm sorry to come back to the governance aspect of this the whole time, but since that's my area of work, is what you see sometimes in boards is that you get almost like a mirror image of the executive side on the board side. And it's good to have similar capacities. But if you get too close kind of sets of skills around the executive director and the chair, for example, you might set up a bit of a, not competition, but a bit of a who is actually right here, where the board might be not questioning where the organization is going, but how they're doing it. And so really getting into the operations and details around that. And that they have different ways of kind of them persuading their people to support them in different ways. But, and I guess this comes back to a part of the campaigning organization, which is, it's in part metrics. So more difficult to see if are we having the impact that we're seeking. And the other one is around, just how people communicate, interpersonally.
Yes,
and if they see, that moment also as one of campaigning for that reason, and that people are driven by passion, which is a very, very strong emotion. It gives you a sense of purpose, or it gives you a sense of void sometimes if you're not having the impact you want. And so I think when you get that strong emotional connection to where you think the organization should go, it may be a bit less less rational, but the discussion may be too invested in the discussion.
Too invested, and it may also be maybe I think the word judgment comes to my mind. Right, there is often with strong passion, especially within organizations that amongst others do campaigning or are solely focused on. There's a fair amount of judgment on others who don't share that opinion that I think can make conflicts more endemic because when people feel their identity is being attacked, then, you know, that drives up the emotions further. That's my sense, at least.
Thank you.
Now, do you, I mean, it's been written up in the media, at least here in the US, my second home country, and also somewhat in Europe, that there have been these high profile, long lasting internal strife, I would say strife, not just conflict, but strife in the last, let's say, 5 to 8 years, that is actually endangering the amount of external impact civil society organizations can have. Do you have a sense that there is an increase in internal strife from your, let's say you and I are both talking, not based on hard data, but based on our limited sets of examples, if you will, right, by nature. But do you have a sense that there is more internal strife now that it also gets into the open, is not pushed down, etc., than, let's say, 10 years ago?
I think there is definitely more tension. I think there are a different number of different aspects of that. I think new people have come to shine in organizations as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not only that. It's not only the internal strife. I'm not also sure what it may be in terms of kind of what are the dividing lines, what are the camps.
Yeah.
But I do think that the increasingly, and this has been constant, right, for quite a long time, the increasingly gloomy financial perspectives of these organizations are really quite are putting pressures on staffing, on what is prioritized, agreeing on which part of the strategy should be scrapped because we can't do everything. So the idea of coming to a prioritization that people are behind is really key.
Very painful.
Yes. Absolutely. And turnover in terms of leadership. And the rest. So I think that the external pressure is really key. There is then the other trend since, I guess, 30 years or more that of the traditional international NGOs around where does the power lie? Where is the authority? Who decides on what, et cetera, which are, I think, not being resolved, but they're clearly being explored in so many different ways in different organizations. And it's high time, of course. But I think that then there are other organizations where I think they're thriving financially in terms of getting income, but still having to prioritize and I don't know, leaving one country or closing for reasons of efficiency or necessity. It's never an easy decision to take. So again, I think that the ability of the joint leadership to communicate not only all of the bad things that need to be done, but also at the same time, we need to do all this because we're going to a place which is better. And so having that vision to drive people towards that and knowing why people are contributing to that is really important.
Really important, yeah. There are so many other things that I would have liked to discuss, but we are already at time. It's gone really fast. So let me ask you, Daniel, as we bring this to a close, you have this big resource of governance-related expertise. And within that, now you have an additional kind of expertise on conflict mediation. Where would you like people to go to find out more about you as a resource and things you have maybe written about or said in public and things like that? Or where can people go to find out more about you?
Well, I'm approachable on LinkedIn, Daniel Genberg. I don't know. I think I'm one of the few with that full name. So you'll find me there. If interested in trainings on mediation, the one I took was for the Center for Effective Dispute Resolution.
Okay.
And they do it mostly in London, but in other places as well. I found it very good, very, very experienced facilitators, a lot of practice, very intense, but I thought it was very, very good and inspiring. So that's where you would find me on LinkedIn or through you. So I'd be happy to explore more about that with the people if they're interested.
Thank you so much. I found it so interesting to learn more about conflict and conflict management, conflict mediation, and the skills that you've had. It's something that I think all of us in the sector can really benefit from. So thank you, Daniel, for all your insights. And thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast episode stimulating, then be sure to check out some of the other ones that we have on the podcast that touch upon governance issues as well as organizational ethics, how nonprofits have dealt with scandals that have impacted our sectors, etc. So, for instance, episode 24 on episode 36 and 37 on the NGO halo effect and the virtual narrative are ones that I would definitely recommend. And you can find those episodes and more on my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, with the number 5, as well as on my YouTube channel. One last thing, if this conversation or another one on the podcast prompts with you an idea that you'd like to have just a 1-hour advisory call with me, if you don't have the budget right now as an organization to invest in a longer term engagement, if you don't have the time right now, but you want that kind of a touch point from an advisory perspective, you can now book those calls directly through my website. Again, fiveoaksconsulting.org. And with that, I say goodbye to all of you and till we see each other again on NGO Soul and Strategy.
Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance: The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@fiveoaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.